coming to you from Orange County, California. This is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, what is up? Chad Wesley Smith here, another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm joined today, not as always, my normal co-host Max is not here, but I'm in Georgia with guest Brett Bartholomew. Brett, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, thanks. And thanks for welcoming my barking dog here as well.
I gotta worry about that. So we're with Brett here in Georgia. Big fan of your book, Conscious Coaching.
Before
we get into that and some of the topics related to that, for our listeners who don't know you, you have a very interesting, inspiring story about, you know, kind of getting in to the world of strength and conditioning and getting interested in that. If you could briefly share some about your background and what brought you to where you are now.
Yeah, within that story specifically. Sure. Yeah, I'll give everybody the Reader's Digest version. So growing up as a competitive athlete, I had real close network of friends, as any of you that played, you know, baseball or football or any other sport throughout your early years and maybe still to this day had. We had competed together for a long time. You know, you just knew all their families. Eventually, as I transitioned into high school, a lot of the kids that I grew up with and that core group of friends got into some pretty hardcore drugs. And I'm talking about cocaine, you know, meth in some circumstances. And during that same time, my family or my parents were going through a divorce. So I didn't really know what to do with a lot of that anxiety and energy and emotion as a kid. You know, I had always channeled that into sport. So that's what I started doing even more so. Became fanatical specifically about training because it was a way that you could literally exercise your demons, pardon the double entendre. So I started taking my training up. I wasn't hanging out with these friends anymore. And I had no kind of social circle. So all that time just became me working out and following really bad advice from whatever magazines were around at the time. I'm 14, right? So this was a time where nutrition advice was kind of really going from low fat, no fat to low carb. So first of all, I did both of those things because I thought...
Simultaneously.
Yeah. Did both those things because I'm just... At that point, especially an extremist, and you're channeling all your energy into, all right, well, if these guys are going to do this, I'm just going to focus on getting myself better. Like, screw them. I started training 3 days a week. I'd run and lift after school. I'd go home, and after dinner, I didn't really want to be home just because of, you know, the nature of the environment. And so I'd go work out again, and then Christian Bale style and American Psycho, before bed, I'd do push-ups and crunches ad nauseum. So long story short, it eventually coalesced into just... manifested as a depression. You know, I became OCD. It was almost like a machine. This was all I did. It was the only thing that kept me focused and really buffered all the outside noise going on in my life. One day I blacked out, found myself in a doctor's office, and he said, hey, you know, here's the reality of your vitals. You're down near around 39 beats per minute. You're malnourished. Your kidneys and liver are both near failure. And we're going to commit you to an eating disorder hospital. I lost my shit.
That was more Christian Bale machinist.
Yeah, there's perfect Bale, analogy. Well, hearing a doctor sit here and say you have an eating disorder, I'm a 14 or 15 year old guy who's lifting weights. And in my opinion, like, I didn't have that. But really looking back on it, when your breakfast as a 14 year old is egg beaters, fat free, you know, Kraft singles and turkey bacon, probably have a bit of an eating disorder. But the point wasn't to lose weight. It just became a compulsion. Like, how could I train perfectly? How could I eat perfectly? And so was admitted to an inpatient eating disorder hospital, spent a year of my life there, very much like the movie, with James Caan, where he's held hostage as an author. What's that movie? She's a fan of the, you almost feel like a hostage. You're in this eighth floor of a hospital in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Is that where you grew up?
No, I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. Oh, yeah. So in the shadow of Husker Power and strength and conditioning, mm-hmm. So I had already been transfixed by this kind of stuff early on. But so I'm in this hospital in Minnesota because that's where these specialists were. Apparently the best of the best. And, you know, every morning you're woken up at around 5 or 5:30. Your blood's drawn. They make a decision based on your body weight and your vitals and all these things, whether you can shower or not, because the initial shock of hot or cold could send you into cardiac arrest. Now, normally when I was healthy at this age, at 14, I was around 130 pounds. By the time I was admitted to this hospital, I was about 95. And, so I couldn't shower for the first 2 weeks. You then spend all your time in a day room, this little small, let's call it maybe 400 to 500 square feet room surrounded by plexiglass. Outside of that plexiglass are the nurses, doctors. You're kind of in this observation room. And this is where you spend time essentially just between meals. The hospital makes you eat six times a day, pre-ordered meals that are really created by the nutritionist there. You have to have a certain, they go off the diabetic exchange ratio. So you had to have a certain amount of carbohydrates, fats, proteins, milks, even desserts, you know, things like that, that would boost caloric density. And about every hour and a half, you're shuttled into this kitchen or dining room. It's an all glass table. There's nurses at both ends. It's glass because they don't want people hiding food, because people would mask food. They do all kinds of stuff. You're in there with patients with a variety of backgrounds. 60-year-old woman whose husband left her. Bulimia became her way of dealing with that. Junior Olympic wrestler who lost a national tournament and his father beat him. So he developed OCD in terms of training and nutrition to try to minimize any variables that would really, you know, could lead to another loss and subsequently disappointing his father and having a recurrence. A girl that was in the middle of nine children and just felt like she had there was no attention placed on her. So her eating disorder was a way of kind of, you know, dealing with that. The point is you had all these people who the food was not really the issue. It was a manifestation of a bigger thing going on. Mm-hmm. The issue with this hospital is essentially you'd go to these groups where you'd have to meet with therapists, and weekly you'd have to meet with psychologists and psychiatrists. And even though these people were heavily and highly credentialed, they always just kind of pigeonholed their diagnosis. They made it about the food. They didn't really listen to client or patients when they were talking about what else was going on in their life. Every time I tried saying, hey, like, this place isn't meant for me. You know, I deal with these things. I have some anger issues, whatever. The answer was either to try to medicate you more or to say that you were being non-compliant, and you'd get a little check on the clipboard and stay in there longer. Now, again, you can't leave this place. There's no exercise. In that day room, if you fidget, if you chew gum, if you stand, you're reprimanded because of non-exercise thermogenesis. They think you're trying to burn calories. So if you're standing or fidgeting, one rap on the wall or the plexiglass. If you do something else, you'll get a second warning. If you do something a third time that they think is just too much activity, right? Anything non-sedentary, you are disciplined by either having to drink a boost or ensure, like essentially a meal replacement, or you're fed intravenously. Only once you're at a certain percentage of your BMI, which is ridiculous as we know BMI is to gauge anything health-wise, are you allowed to exercise. And that basically is four steps down a hallway with 3-pound ankle weight sitting on a stability ball doing leg extensions and planks. Again, everything is very controlled. So without belaboring it and going into the rest of what's discussed in the book, eventually I'd met a certain standard where I could leave the hospital for an hour. And my parents happened to be up visiting because you're spending, you know, this whole year, this was my home. So I leave the hospital and I go into a Barnes & Noble or some other bookstore. Don't quote me on what it was. And I just know that whatever the hospital is teaching me isn't working. They keep saying, hey, you need this. This is how you regain the weight. And I'm sitting here saying, like, what, eating shit food and not working out or doing anything? Like, this is supposed to be a healthy integration? Come on. But I don't know anything at the time. So I steal two books. One was Mike Arthur's book. It was Complete Conditioning for Football. And then another one was Nancy Clark's Sports Nutrition Guidebook. And I had to hide these in the book jackets of other books because when you go back into the hospital, they check everything you bring in because they don't want any paraphernalia, so to speak, around diet, nutrition, exercise, yeah. What have you. So I go in and I just, you know, in my spare time, when I am in my room, like when you actually, and the only time you get to go to your room is at night when you go to bed or in the morning, and they check on you periodically, about 30 to 45 minute intervals. They want to make sure you're not exercising. They want to make sure you're still breathing because some people are in that bad of a health state. But I literally am having to time when these people are coming to check to read this stuff. I read everything I can. Eventually, by the grace of God, you know, I get transferred to a therapist within the hospital that finally helps my parents and realize, hey, this probably isn't a place for him. If anything, this place is a bit toxic. And that was admitted by our own standard. You know, I think you got to trust him here and you've got to give this a second chance. But I don't think that this is a healthy place. Got out of the hospital. And again, I'm fast forwarding rapidly. and applied everything I had read from these books, just tried to get my nutrition state to a better place, exercising the right way, gained 56 pounds in 3 months, submitted a story later on to Muscle and Fitness magazine, got in that. It was cool. It was a success story.
Incredible bulking story.
Yeah, just, well, I mean, like, but here's the thing, right? Like, your life depended on it. It was basically that or go back to this shithole hospital. And one of the things that I don't want to be lost upon in the listeners is a lot of this story and why I ended up going the route that I did in strength and conditioning is, one, I saw right there that proper training and nutrition can save a life. It's not just about performance. Like, it can alter a life. Two, the coaching piece and why I do art of coaching and so much psychosocial communication stuff now is what you learn is no matter how decorated or educated somebody is, if they don't understand people, that can also cost a life. I saw a lot of people in that hospital not get the help they needed because of the so-called experts in their new shit about personality or human behavior.
Yeah, they wanted to put you guys all into one archetype.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that's what led me down the path of strength and conditioning and now subsequently really coach development and communication.
Well, all right. I'd heard it in the book, but that is a pretty remarkable background to and very unique background, certainly among strength and conditioning coaches. So to try and create some kind of segue there, as we mentioned, these experts, quote, yeah, you know, air quotes, we're trying to shove everyone in this hospital situation into all of you have this problem, and this is the one way that we fix it. I think most people's probably biggest takeaway from the book Conscious Coaching are these athlete archetypes.
Yeah.
And you going, you know, doing just the opposite of what these so-called experts had done to you. And rather than saying everyone gets fixed, everyone gets treated this same way, but you've looked at all these different archetypical situations, and this is how we can best address all of these problems. So as you're helping educate coaches, what is sort of the first step that you would advise them to in to beginning to assess their athletes and where they might fall into these different categories?
Yeah, I think even before that, coaches really need to be self-aware. You know, that was one thing the hospital did afford me as I was sitting here looking at all the other patients and the odd things that they were doing. It's funny, I tend to look at that and I'm like, this person's crazy. Like, what? But then you're completely ignoring what you're doing, right? And that's what's called fundamental attribution error. You look at somebody else doing something and you say, well, that person's insane, right? It's a person issue. But if you're doing something else a little goofy, it's a situation issue. We're really quick to justify it or rationalize it. So I think before you even look at archetypes, you have to be self-aware and understand that within the archetypes, things are still going to be fluid. And I think this was something that I didn't realize. I didn't make apparent enough in the book. You'll have to tell me. But I took some heat early on with the book because people were saying that I was trying to treat or diagnose or typecast people into certain patterns of behavior. And there's nothing in that book that talks about diagnosing or that archetypes should be the only way that you go about things. Archetypes are fluid and they're situation dependent, meaning somebody, an athlete coming into the weight room may present a certain characteristic or trait. But when that athlete is with their family or in a social setting, they may be very different. As when they're on their own, they may be very different. Myself as a coach, I'm an example of that. When I'm coaching or presenting or speaking on a podcast with a friend, I'm going to be a little bit more charismatic, loquacious. We're going to talk a good bit. When I'm here and there's nobody around me, I don't want to be bothered and I just want to read a book. I'm fairly introverted in that respect. So I think helping coaches understand that an archetype, by definition of the term, is a mold or a typical example of behavior. It's just a pattern. And we see this every day. You go to a movie, there's a hero and there's a villain. You're on social media, there's the selfie bro, there's the political person, there's the woman that wants to post about her cats. There's just typical molds of behavior. Now, you can't look at those things in a vacuum because people are going to be different and there's going to be fluidity to that, which is why I say coaches need self-awareness. You can't look at an athlete and be like, Billy doesn't want to squat, they're soft, they're the royal archetype. No, maybe Billy just doesn't understand what squatting does to enhance performance. And so that's the thing is, when I was in the hospital, they look at me and say, here's a 97-year-old or 97-pound 14-year-old. He must have an issue with food. Really, my issue wasn't with food as much as it was just depression and lack of control in my life. And so that became a manifestation of what can I control? Food, diet, whatever. It was a way for me to channel energy. So the archetypes are about you understanding and being more conscious of your environment, seeing the landscape there, and knowing that you're going to have to adapt your coaching style. Doesn't matter if you're a John Wooden type as a coach or a Bobby Knight. And it, who are we to even say what's right and what's wrong? A kid from southeast part of St. Louis is going to want to be coached a little differently than a kid from rural Iowa. Now, that's not always the case, but by and large, I think most people that have coached for a while would agree. You can't coach everybody the same. And that's what the archetypes are about. Just understand the landscape, see what's out there, and know that you're going to have to be adaptable as a communicator.
Green Chef is a USDA certified organic company that makes eating well easy and affordable with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. Green Chef lets you choose from a wide array of easy to follow lifestyles with select organic ingredients. Their meal plans include paleo, vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian, Mediterranean, heart smart, lean and clean, keto, gluten-free, and omnivore. With Green Chef, it's easy to eat well and discover new recipes every week that you'll love to cook. Green Chef's expert chefs design flavorful recipes for your lifestyle that go way beyond ordinary substitutions. So let Green Chef do the meal planning, grocery shopping, and most of the prep for your week, for you week after week. Green Chef sent me their keto box the other week. Really tasty, easy to do. Definitely a good value if you don't have time to do all your own meal prep, but you still enjoy cooking. So for $50 off your first box of Green Chef, go to greenchef.us/juglife. That's $50 off your first box of Green Chef. Go to greenchef.us, not .com, greenchef.us/juglife.
Now, to that effect, have you seen a big shift over the last, you know, 3-5 years as social media has become so much more prevalent, a big shift in personality of your athletes and what they seem to respond to?
Yeah, I just think in general, you have people that are a little bit more, and this is multifaceted. Athletes in general, it's been an interesting dichotomy and shift, especially in the professional world, because people are just a little bit more inherently distrusting. They're also a little bit more, look at me, everybody feels like they have a platform. You know, it's kind of like fake rage now is the new black. Everybody feels like their voice can be heard and they've got to put on a show or they've got to be something that they're not. I don't know if that's even just social media. I think that was the rise of the internet that happened. And I think even before those times, there were probably coaches that engaged in what's called, sociologists call, impression management. People are always going to go to great lengths to try to convey a certain self-image, whether that's the expert, whether that's I'm, you know, a power lifter, like everybody verbally and non-verbally conveys some kind of information about themselves. I think social media has just amplified it, and primarily because we don't know how to use it really well. I think social media is still a relatively new innovation to the point where we bitch about the mediums, but it's really the messengers. There are lots of people that use social media for really great things. I sit on the board for a nonprofit organization that helps inner city kids learn more about training and movement. If it wasn't for social media, how do we reach those kids? You know? And so to me, it plays a role, but I don't know that it's always the scapegoat that people want it to be. I think that if anything, it's polluted the coach or trainer or whatever you are, you know, listening to this. I think it's polluted that landscape a little bit more because it's turned what we do into the wild, wild west, even more so than the forums of yesteryear, right, that people had where people could get away with making it seem like they were doing stuff they weren't really doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think your point there about almost the coach becoming an archetype and trying to – it's simple to fit into – yeah, to take it to the political side of things, you see someone wearing a MAGA hat, and a lot of assumptions are going to be made about that person.
Right.
You know, gun, you know, pro-gun, this and that, all these different things. You see a coach who is about Westside, or they're about weightlifting, or they're about functional patterns, or whatever it is, and there's like so many other pieces that are attached to that. Where in the same way that an athlete, yeah, we might be able to categorize them in this. The royal archetype or whatever.
Loose categorization.
Yeah, but not every single facet of their personality is going to be identical as someone else in that who might fit loosely into that archetype. The same idea with the coaches. And I noticed the shirt you were wearing the other day and a picture that said adaptable.
Yeah.
On it. That's
the art of coaching shirt. When I first put together the art of coaching, I'm like, what's the first shirt we make? Well, what are we trying to do? I'm trying to make coaches more adaptable. And So that is, you're spot on. Coaches fit in. These archetypes aren't exclusive to athletes. They're for all of us, right? And if you're not, we had somebody that bought the book. It was a law firm. They're like, this coincides with clients and even members of my legal team. I spoke about the book at Microsoft, and they said, we have software designers, engineers, Salesforce, all these people fit into certain archetypical characteristics. At the same time, it's not an absolute list. And some people, you know, would say, oh, these are based on Carl Jung's work and Jungian archetypes, and this is hogwash. And again, the archetypes aren't absolutes, and you can say whatever you want about the research of that. The reality is that every time you go out into public, you're going to see typical examples of behavior. The aggressive driver, you're going to see the talker, the quiet. These things exist. They're not to be debated. So no matter what you think of Carl Jung or his work, typical patterns of behavior exist. They're just incomplete. So what I tell people is, much like you never just get married to one model of training or one exercise or one set and rep scheme, what you have to understand is people also are not one archetype. There are people that can present two or three archetypical characteristics at once. Humans are complex. That's why you're never really going to be able to, nobody is ever going to write a manual on how to coach everybody. And I know we have this fervent desire for that stuff. What's the best warm-up? What's the best way to squat? What's the best way to do this? You have to understand, not you, but all of us, a collective you, have to understand that we're not CPAs. There's not just one way to do your taxes here. Training is fluid. So is the communication. But we never learn the communication piece, right? Because we're too busy reading ebooks on that sit here and debate training modalities. Not that those aren't important, but at the end of the day, it's the communication that's going to get the athletes to do these things at a high enough level. Coaches, we care about training, right? Like if somebody tells you and I to go train hard right now, boo-hoo, like we're going to go out and we're going to strain. Athletes aren't always the same way. There's some people that don't give a shit about that. So if you can't communicate it in a way that resonates, your programming falls flat to a degree to begin with.
I think that the athlete's relationship to the training too, there's a big difference, and see if you have noticed this as well, between individual sport athletes and team sport athletes. You know, as we deal with pretty much all powerlifters and weightlifters, training is their sport.
Yeah.
You know, where football players, basketball players, like that's not the fun stuff.
No.
You know, they want to go play the games, and everything else is sort of a tough piece to it. Have you any strategies or any advice you can offer in terms of dealing with the individual sport athlete versus the team sport athlete?
Yeah, within the book, I talk about four drives that were really brought to light by two Harvard business professors that looked at just evolutionary psychology, Paul Lawrence and Nathan Noria. And what they show is, and by the way, a drive is not the same as a motivation, just so we're clear on nomenclature here for anybody listening, because this can get sticky. A motivation is something that's not indelible. We can all watch a YouTube video or listen to a song and get temporarily motivated. Drives.
I have a series of animal memes that I look at actually every morning.
Perfect.
Some days I'm a lion. Some days a lone wolf.
What are you today?
Hippo.
A hippo.
Yeah.
And what's the hippo connotate?
You know, fast through the water, dangerous, but no one realizes.
They're aggressive. Do I need to look out right now? But a drive is, you can think of it as a subconscious influencer of behavior. So there's a researcher at USC. His name's Antonio Damasio. And he looks at cognitive neuroscience and says, these are the things that typically whisper in the background that really control our day-to-day actions, habits, and behaviors. And so Paul Lawrence and Nathan Noria talk about the four drive model. There's primarily, and again, these aren't absolutes, the drive to learn, the drive to acquire, the drive to bond, and the drive to defend. So what I notice, and let's use American football as an example, just because I coached some guys this morning, so it's relevant and recent. What I notice is when I do competitions that invoke drive to acquire some kind of status, like I'm the fastest guy or somebody signed the biggest contract, whatever, and we pair it up with a guy that's got the drive to defend, somebody who already is that alpha, like I am the fastest guy, I already have the biggest contract, we see a lot of really good, healthy competition, right? That's your one-on-one push-up starts, even utilizing that in velocity-based training, moving the bar, you know, whatever anybody thinks of that. Just good individual competition. Now, linemen tend to be a little bit more drive to bond. I notice when we do team competitions and things, when they can kind of impose their will collectively, they're a little bit more oriented to do that. So that could be, you know, the other day we did some shuttle relays where teams had to group up, and to make sure none of them coast or cheat, you know, we'll pair them up, and they get they usually got a fast guy, kind of a middle of the pack guy, and a slow as shit guy. And everybody's got to bust it, because a slow guy doesn't want to be the reason they lose. The fastest guy, right? It's collective. So whenever you address the collective, that usually helps with the drive to bond. Now, to make this a little bit more salient, most of your listeners, and I would imagine everybody at this table, we're drive to learn, right? You like to acquire knowledge. You like to challenge yourself. But you're also drive to bond. That's why you have a podcast and you're trying to spread a message to other people. Everybody is some scale. It's almost like an investment portfolio. It's diversified. Some people have a little bit more of one drive and some others are channeled. But I think as a coach, what I'm getting at, Chad, is you've got to look at what drills am I going over and what's going to resonate with people. Some athletes that might be more drive to learn, they really love the technical cueing. What angle am I at? Where's the body position? What posture? Some guys don't give a shit about that. They just want to go. And pardon my language. I don't know if this is an edited.
You can say whatever you want.
Right. So like, I think what I do is I say, what was my session today, both in the weight room and movement wise? That's why I do speed, agility, what have you. Did I address the technical specifications? Did I address the physiological needs? And what about the psychosocial aspect? Where did guys seem to get engaged and where weren't they? So the four drives is kind of what I look at that as, is just, am I speaking not only the same language in terms of verbiage that these guys want to hear things in, but am I looking at what motivates them as well? It's not catering, it's adapting. Like, some people are like, who gives a shit? Make these guys do whatever. Well, do you want your programming to elicit higher level adaptations or not? Because you still have to get these guys to do that. Buy-in, to me, the definition of buy-in is commitment plus trust, not obedience. You could coach somebody today and get them to do something. That's obedience. But when they're committed and they trust you, they're going to do that at a higher level.
Very cool. So we were talking about it a little bit before we started recording, but so to take a turn from this to get into the business of coaching. I know you've been the nomadic coach, moving all over the country as so many people have, and you know, we've interviewed other college strength coaches and they list off 9 different schools that they've been at in the last 10 years, kind of things. That the business of coaching, so many people listening, and when I was, you know, I started Juggernaut when I was 22, but when
That's
I
incredible.
Was 19, 20, 21, wanting to do this, I had this vision of what the business of coaching was about.
Sure.
You know, that it was just about coaching, and I was going to have this gym, and we're going to train all these badass athletes, and then started doing it, and was like, oh man, there's marketing, and there's taxes, and there's cleaning bathrooms, and there's all this shit. And then when you're in the collegiate setting or professional setting, it's even a whole different thing where you know you've got to report to your head strength coach and the athletic director and then the president of the school, and you've got the head coaches of the sports and all these different bosses, where I think that turns a lot of people to wanting to get into the private sector. But you've been there, I've been there. It's tough sometimes to say I'm going to make a living, or I'm going to value myself properly. So as someone who creates content, as someone who coaches, has coached at all these at all these different levels, what advice would you give to young coaches when it comes to, you know, the business of coaching and properly valuing their expertise?
Yeah. You touched on a good point. I think the one thing I'm really grateful for that I did early is I wanted experience in the team setting and private sector. I think that's the first thing I'd start with, and it's the bedrock of the advice I'm going to give to follow that up on that question. There are so many coaches that still think there's only one way to do this. They've got to go to a major Division I university, and I was fortunate to have some time there as a volunteer at Nebraska. I was at Southern Illinois as a graduate assistant, or they want to work for a pro team. But I don't think they always know the realities of things. I think of periodization and program design. We always talk about begin with the end in mind. Who takes that approach with their career in our field? And I know I didn't at first, because I had these same aspirations. I was like, oh, I want to do this and this and this. And then it became a point, and there's only so much I can share on this. Just like, there became a point where you realize that everything you do when you work for somebody else to a degree is owned by them. I had a great time in the private sector with a large organization, a lot of which I have to credit the skills that I've gained in many ways. But I knew when I wanted to write the book, it was a very clear, you can't write the book here. And I looked at it and I thought, well, my wife and I want to have a family, and I need to find some way to make extra money, because they've told me I've capped out. So what do I do? Well, around that same time, I got offered a head assistant job with an NFL team. But I had already made a decision prior to that contract coming through that I'd sign on at another facility who was like, hey, you know what? You can run some of the business stuff. You can do the coaching. And I looked at my wife right now and I said, we have the opportunity to do something that I've coveted for about half a decade now, going to work in the NFL. At the same time, like, I know that I need to learn certain skills that if shit hits the fan, we're protected from a business standpoint. Now, the NFL would have given me a lot more followers, a lot more passive respect. There's a lot that comes with that acronym, right? And I wanted to do that because I'd worked with that population quite a bit. But I'd already given my word to another organization and I tried to look at it and I said, okay, I'm going to learn the business side and this. And I did. I learned a lot of lessons, good, bad, and ugly. When you put skin in the game, you do that. And I don't think a lot of coaches... We talked about this before, you're right. I was a purist, even probably until around 3 or 4 years ago, where all I ever heard in my head was people say, real strength coaches aren't on social media. Real strength coaches don't have a brand. Real strength coaches don't do this. And so I started looking at it, I'm like, well, what are we, coal miners? Like, I'm just supposed to stay in the trenches until I'm 75 years old and like never worry about what I'm worth, never. So I said, screw this. I looked at my wife and I go, we're going to bet on ourselves right now. And I'm going to get more involved in this community, but I'm going to do it in a way that I think I would have liked it to be done for me. So there's all this bullshit out there. Everybody wants to make it overly complicated. So when I got on social media, I wasn't trying to show cool exercises. I was showing a 4-time World Series champion doing an RDL and doing it correctly. Fundamentals, not fluff, was kind of this tagline. I was showing people doing plyometrics just cleanly, not on 80-inch boxes or whatever it is. And so that started to just garner a little bit of a following. So I knew I was resonating with some people, probably just people like myself that felt like underdogs that were looking for something honest. And then, you know, I put the chips on the table finally when I said, we're going to go out on our own. And when that kind of fear hits you, when you don't have a salary to protect you, none of us have a pension unless you have a SEP IRA that's independently funded, or I guess some NFL or major sporting organizations, I think, do after they're there 10 years, but it's going away. I started looking at like, what can we create that can help people that we can own? And I'm sorry if I'm being long-winded on this. So I said, we're going to write the book. I was clueless. I had no mailing list. I had to take out a $25,000 loan to get that thing self-published. We didn't have that kind of money. You know, I was 4 years into the field before I even made $30,000. Mm-hmm. And now I'm taking out a $35,000 loan. I had no idea what to do marketing wise, but somehow that book went viral. And then I said, if I'm going to continue to do this, I've got to learn more about this world. And you see it with a guy like John Gruden, coached for a long time, got out of it because he didn't like the cannibalistic nature of it and some other things, built really a brand for himself, and then look, went back to coaching on his own terms. So I said, if we can do that, if I can still coach, but I can also be involved in coach education because I never had a direct mentor, I want to give that. Can we create a platform where now we have this kind of, we've built the well before we're thirsty? And so, yeah, a lot of learnings there, a lot of things that made me feel guilty when I put myself out there, because you keep hearing these. But I just think strength and conditioning is in this weird adolescent phase right now where it doesn't know what it wants to be. You have people that clearly want to be out there and be heard and make an impact. They don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. So they've sullied the well a little bit. So we've created this reservoir of poor associations with what it means to market yourself and brand yourself, just because a lot of people did it without any education or integrity. But in reality, that's where we need to go. You already sell yourself a million times a day to the athletes or people you work with. You get them to understand the value of an exercise. You use a certain cue or command that resonates with them. If you need a budget increase at a team, you've got to make a compelling case. So why not do that on a larger scale?
And you know, that was a distinction I started making probably about 2012, and I mentioned it a few times in interviews and articles and stuff, is that when Juggernaut started creating a lot of content in 2012, it was very important to me that we were coaches who put stuff on the internet, not internet coaches.
It's a good distinction.
And I had seen these, I saw these people, you know, in the only, what, 6, going on 7 years ago now, but what seems like a lifetime ago in terms of the business and marketing for everything, people who had never really coached anyone, but they were the ones who had the big mailing lists and all this stuff. And it was so frustrating to me. And I was like, I don't want to be like that. We want to be coaches who put stuff on the internet, people who really do this stuff on the day to day, but want to share that information with the best people. is I always figured it's going to be easy to learn how to, relatively easy to learn how to do the marketing part of things, much easier than the marketing people could learn how to do the coaching part of things. But even in that, you know, I found myself struggling with that same distinction of, you know, these are things I would do for free, but if I do them for free, then I can't actually do them anymore.
Well, you're devaluing it. And that was like, I mean, we hosted a big event. It was, I say we, like, it's still me, but I had some.
I say we for me all the time.
Right. And so.
It makes you sound fancy.
Yeah. Well, I just had some, well, I'm trying to grow a team and I'm trying to make it not about me. So, but we did an event in January called Valued with the ED in parentheses, like value education. And it was all about that of, you know, all these things that are rooted in humility and good intentions are great, but taken beyond a certain spectrum or scale or scope, however you want to phrase it, it's devaluing what you do. And, you know, I unfortunately have yet to meet a doctor or a dentist I can go to that won't charge me. Well, I probably could, but I don't think the service would be great. And I started just kind of, it was all around how we need to get over this stuff. And we made it an online course. It comes out April 24th, but it's just about those struggles of, you have to understand the more you kind of stay in these shadows. I know that seems like the altruistic, good, humble thing to do. But if you constantly say it's not about the money, I'll work harder than anybody, it's all about the grind, all these self-sacrificial kind of mantras and phrases that somehow become almost like cult-like in strength and conditioning, what you're really telling people is you don't, like, you're expendable. And you see that. Look at the coach turnover. I think we joke that the NFL stands for not for long. I think the average coaching contract is shorter than the average career span in the NFL at this point. I mean, what are you going to go on, a recurring cycle of 2 to 3 year contracts? Mm-hmm. And what do you expect? Do you expect the GM, the owner, the administrators to pay you well when you're constantly showing that you'll do whatever it takes to undercut the other guy? So say there's a job for $35,000. You see undercutting, belittling. You see people staying from, even if they don't have to be there at 4:30 in the morning, will stay there till 8:30 at night. And again, was guilty at one point because I bought into that. But it's all just like, what are you telegraphing to the outside world? And then we're supposed to feel bad when you charge for your time. Somebody DM'd me the other day, and I'm not trying to be rude, but they said, "Hey bro, can you tell me about your book?" And, you sit there and it's like your 39th DM that you're answering about this. And you want to say, well, can't you just go to like Amazon? Like there's a full description on Amazon.
Google, you may
have
heard
of that. There's a full chapter. Like I give away a full free chapter online. And then you tell him a little bit about it because you feel compelled. And he's like, cool, like any tips for my career? Well, literally, I have a 52-page ebook of all the mistakes I made.
Okay, here's a whole book about it.
But they don't give a shit. And so like then eventually what I started doing, because it was affecting my marriage, you know, my first year of marriage, I'm sitting there answering every Twitter DM. Again, because I feel like nobody ever answered my stuff. I want to do it for everybody. My wife would be like, you ever going to get off the phone? So eventually what I learned really just this year is if somebody asks a super in-depth question, like the other day, somebody goes, what do you think of FRC? I'm like, bud, I would love to chat with you about this, but like I have 3 jobs that I really manage. Give me a call sometime. Here's the link. And he goes, whoa, I have to pay for your time. And I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, like you generally got to pay for things or earn them in life. Mm-hmm. You can earn them if you want to come help and you want to come be a part of this, or you got to pay it because guess what? The knowledge I acquired on that topic wasn't free either. And it's just odd. It's odd because, again, I don't know what other profession. If I have a handyman come out, we just moved not long ago, I couldn't imagine being like, whoa, I have to pay for you putting that sink together? Are you crazy? I thought if you were in this for the right reasons, bro, I just thought you'd put my sink in. But our field's so odd in that it's got to grow up.
Yeah, that's been a big frustration to me, especially with the as beneficial as YouTube has been, as beneficial as Instagram has been, it has devalued the information in some sense because there's so much for free. And I mean, I almost probably screwed myself over in some cases because we'd make these videos and I'd just say everything I thought about.
It's crazy expensive to do that. Time-wise and financially too. And when you think about that, we mentioned this prior too, most of the people in my family have died in their 70s. And so I'm a very urgent I communicate with urgency because I just don't feel like we have a whole lot of time, especially I wasted a year of my life in a hospital. And so anything I put out there, it's with purpose and I try not to put shit out there. So if I put it out there, look at it because I promise it's time away from my wife, you know, all those kinds of things. And eventually it's funny that we're talking about this because you had no idea, but that's why I put together that event. And that's why I'm doing this course. I just got so tired of it. I'm like, well, I could bitch about it or I could kind of share the information and maybe even the psychological underpinnings of where this kind of came from to begin with, because I'm getting my my doctorate in related subject of why we do these things, why these impression management tactics, why these power dynamics, why the politics, why the envy and ego and insecurity. And so it's why I'm doing a whole course around it now, because it's holding our profession back, because we're not acting like professionals, somebody who by definition, a professional gets paid for their expertise and their work. And it doesn't mean you're not in it for the right reasons. It means that, guess what? If I go to the bank and say, huh, I understand I have a mortgage to pay, but I'm in my job for the right reasons and I give a lot of my time for free. Are you sure you can't give me a lower interest rate? They'd be like, get out of here.
Yeah, and it even becomes a thing too of, you know, everyone draws their line at a different place of, you know, clickbaity type of stuff or, you know, I think about when I do other people's podcasts, sometimes there's this sort of sliding scale of like reach to credibility kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Whenever you go on someone else's, you contribute an article or whatever, you're lending them some of your credibility. And there's some times where it's like, you know, that one's not worth it to me.
Yeah.
That one, even though they've got this big reach or whatever.
And I'm bad at that. I haven't learned to say no yet because I'm just a people pleaser.
Well, I mean, I got you on this one, so.
Yeah. Well, this was it. But think about the way that you did it, right? You didn't reach out in a transactional fashion. Like, there is a commitment here. I mean, people listening to this don't know he drove a long ways out of his way to come here.
Southern California to Georgia.
Yeah. But like, on the other hand, you know, you'll get reached out. The other day, somebody said, hey, can you meet me for coffee? Never met this person. Another DM example. So, you know, I was, hey, what day are you in town? Yada, yada, yada. Well, they were about 2 hours away and they didn't offer to pay for that time. And it was in the middle of two athlete training groups. So I just said, hey, I would love to meet you. Let me make this clear right now. However, like, even if we met halfway, here's the time commitment and I got other groups. Again, I just got lambasted because I wouldn't go meet the guy. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, dude, like, one, I don't even drink coffee. So you didn't even, and that's nothing like it. I just never acquired the taste, right? There's no like cool reason why I don't drink coffee. I have many other things, so don't feel offended by that. But like, I'm sitting here like, you didn't even reach out in a way where you even know anything about me, yet you're demanding this of me, and now you're getting mad because of a last minute request that I couldn't fulfill. Where you, on the other hand, like, you made this work and it was easy and you came in and so I think that goes back to the approach and the importance of the social side of things, how much that really dictates the path of your career.
Some of it is I don't know if generational is the right word, but I'll say a generational thing when it comes to coaching, because you and I, how old are you?
I just turned 33.
All right, so I turned 33 later this year. I remember we did an episode with Mike Wadango a couple months ago, who's probably about the same, 32 or 33, and we must be right on the youngest end of this group. And that's not to say that there aren't younger people who think this same way, but if you're a little bit younger than us, YouTube and all of that was always prevalent, and information was a bit easier to come by. You know, I'm sure you remember being, you know, 19, 20 years old when Elite FTS would only put articles out on Friday.
Yeah.
And you're waiting all week
to read that article.
Yeah, these four or five articles that came out every Friday, and you were going to read every single one of them. And now, even seminars that I do, like the one I'll do this weekend, and I'll ask people, hey, who's watched this video that I made? Who's watched this? And I was getting so frustrated with it that like a third of the people would raise their hands. And it was blowing my mind, because I was like,
you put so much into it.
Yeah. And just like, why would you pay to come to something if you could have gotten this stuff? So I have it all for free online too.
Right.
And so I brought up Mike Guadagno, because he was telling us about when he interned for James and Buddy, and he's living on an air mattress in a closet. And if you're a little bit older, your only option was go to a seminar, try and track the person down after. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I started coaching high school football when I was 19. And even when I was in high school doing track, being at these track meets and not really having any guidance for lifting and all this stuff, and just finding the coaches and asking them questions until they were like, hey, kid, I got to go do something mm-hmm. else, you know. But now, because it's so easy to access people through social media, that they feel like, well, they've got all the time in the world to just answer my questions.
Yeah.
They don't have to you know, put the skin in the game or make the sacrifice to go pay money to go to an event or to you know, sleep on an air mattress in a, in a storage closet to gather some of this information.
But that's why, I mean, touching on that point, that's why I always tell people now, best advice. I mean, it's so quotidian where somebody's like, what's advice? For years, people would say, oh, get your degree, get an internship, get certified. And you're like, dude, like, really? There's tons of jobs or tons of coaches that have that, and it's not helping them in their career. Now what I tell people is put skin in the game, because otherwise you end up like I was really in my early 20s where, again, anybody that was online, I'm like, faker, idiot, you know, look at this guy's form, can't even get the elbows through. And then you coach long enough and you realize that everything's context. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember one time I was working with five UFC fighters, and literally cinematographers from the UFC were like, can we watch the training session? And I'm like, sure. Well, within that training session, I think we had done, you know, heavy trap bar deadlifts. We had done weighted pull-ups. We had done some kind of one-arm dumbbell bench press. We had done posterior chain work. And then we're doing conditioning now. So they had circuit-based conditioning, some battle ropes. They were doing some medleys with the sled and what have you. And what did the UFC put out? Because I was like, oh, this is going to be great. There's finally going to be footage of fighters doing, like, real shit. Because before it was just all these like gimmicky circuits, right? Yeah, swinging weighted bats at heavy bags and then doing all this. Well, the video comes out and it was almost like probably like my father felt when Johnny Carson came on at night. They're gathering around the TV. I'm like, watch, they're going to show real training now. I practice what I preach. What do they show? Just the prowler and the ropes
battle,
and all the
battle rope montage.
Yeah, just everything. And so then I just get flooded and I'm like, doosh, doosh, taking hits. I used to box competitively. It felt like uppercut. And people were like, oh, I thought you were this. And then I'm like, what? I'll send you the program. We did it. And then I just realized, oh, shit, I shouldn't have been such a inward loudmouth, you know, and criticize all the stuff that I saw online, because you really don't know the context of it. And that's even a marketing lesson I learned within the last year. So I had a follow up to the book. The book's not even 2 years old. It won't be until April. And literally after the book was done, people are like, when's the next book? I go, this took me 3 years. There's no next book next year. But I did do an online course that dives deeper, right? So spent a ton of time on this, built it out. And I remember the folks that helped me with the course, they said, hey, we have to expand the reach. Like, we got to get the average Facebook user interested, people that aren't part of the one percenter community. Paint the dream for us here. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? I go, this course is just about how to communicate more effectively and build trust. And they go, we get that. And for real coaches that do this day in and day out, they will get that. But for the average person that has no clue even what they want to do or isn't even self-aware, you've got to hook them. And I go, that's interesting. I go, well, I'm sitting here thinking, and they're like, Brett, like, what does building trust with people do? I go, well, you get more effort out of them. And to me, that was just obvious. And they're like, well, let's state that. Build more trust and get more effort out of your athletes. That's something that everybody wants to do. But I'm sitting here belaboring why the psychosocial dynamic's important. You know, oh, if you know their wants. So it was a masterclass in marketing, because I realized you do sometimes have to have an above the fold headline to get the attention of people that aren't going to go to the work, like mm-hmm. you said, Chad, to look up your stuff. Now you've almost kind of got to bait them, but you got to bait them ethically.
Yeah.
You have to bait them ethically.
Putting a clickbait headline on an article with good information is not unethical.
And that was something I struggled with. That was something I really didn't understand, because I'd get, again, purist friends that would be like, what you said here is bullshit. And I go, dude, you're not my audience right here. You've read the book. You understand this. And this is where academics fail, because I had a PhD at the time be like, you had no business writing this book. You're not a PhD. And I said, I'm confused here. I need to have a PhD to share my coaching experiences, life lessons, and things that I've gathered along the way. Oh, and by the way, I am getting my doctorate, but don't come at me and try to say I have no right to do this. On the other hand, this guy had never coached anybody. Mm-hmm. So you're sitting here telling me what to write. But yeah, if the information's good, you just have to realize that you got to drive traffic to that. And the emotional brain is always going to beat, you know, these no matter how smart you are, no matter anything else, emotions win. It's completely different if you're trying to defraud somebody, you know, or you're trying to, and we see enough of that. But that was my biggest failure at first with the marketing side, is learning that kind of being like, oh, it's okay. Like, some people just, you know, I literally had to label an ebook that's free, Advice for New Coaches, because people would say, hey, you got any advice for new coaches? And I sent them a book that's like shit that I learned. And they're like, yeah, but is this for new coaches? And I'm like, I give up. I have no idea what to do. I have to put this, if this is what you are looking for, please click here now. And then all these disclaimers. No, just like think and put some effort into your own development. Yeah. So I get heated about it.
Oh, for sure. I'm right there. I'm right there with you. Well, I know you're a busy man. You got stuff to do. So go ahead. Fire off books, links, seminars, all that stuff.
It's super easy. The best way to find all those things without belaboring it is just go to artofcoaching.com. You'll find links to the book. You'll find links to the online classes. You'll find links to speaking clinic, all that. And again, it's not the art of coaching. It is just artofcoaching.com. I'm most active on Instagram at coach_BrettB, but artofcoaching.com will get you anywhere you need to go. And the book's on Amazon worldwide. So Conscious Coaching, Amazon.
Awesome. Well, this was the Jug Life Podcast. 5 stars on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, all those places. If you're interested in online coaching for powerlifting, weightlifting, super total, we've got all those. JTSstrength.com. Follow me at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training. And I'm not exactly sure when this is going to come out, so I won't talk about any seminars coming up. Brett, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Chad.